assessing the first 30 days of the Trump administration. The transition to power for President Donald Trump has been rife with problems, according to some Washington observers. But Trump himself says his administration is operating like a finely tuned machine, and he blames the media for spreading fake news about any perceived White House problems. Trump has certainly kept his promise to shake things up in Washington, but he's also feeling the full force of a powerful response from Democrats, bureaucrats, and even some established members of his own party. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on Maine Calling, we'll look at the latest developments on a number of stories that are now surrounding the president. My guests today include Gene Cummings of the Wall Street Journal, Gordon Adams of American University, and USM's Ron Schmidt. And as always, you. Trump versus the Washington establishment. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. This past Saturday night, President Trump held a campaign-style rally in Florida. There, thousands of his followers cheered as the president blasted what he calls the dishonest media. According to the Washington Post, the president made 13 dubious claims during the event. Today, we're going to talk about the political climate in Washington, the state of the president's cabinet, and how the new administration is functioning 30 days after Donald Trump was sworn in as president. With me in studio, Ron Schmidt. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine and is currently at work on a book about time and trauma in American political thought. It's called The Uncanny Friend: Reading Politics with Machiavelli. Gordon Adams is a professor emeritus at American University School of International Service. He's also a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He was the senior White House budget official for national security budgets from 1993 to 97, and on the OMB transition team for incoming President Barack Obama. And on the line with us from her office in Washington, D.C., Gene Cummings, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And as always, we want to hear from you. What's your take on the Trump transition and the current political climate in our nation's capital? The number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Gene, we'll start with you. It's hard to know where to start these days in the news cycle. But what would you say, out of all the stories that we have emerging around the transition here, that's the investigation into the Russians, the attack on the press, the unity in the White House or lack thereof, problems filling government positions, the immigration order, what's the big story or emerging story out of all those right now as of today?
Well, I think probably the two most important storylines are the Russia investigations. I think there are 7 or 8 of them on Capitol Hill, in addition to whatever work is being done inside of the intelligence communities. So there's a lot that's going to be unpacked there, and much of it we don't know. So that's going to produce a lot of interesting news. And then the second attempt at the immigration ban or travel restrictions, whatever anyone wants to call them. We are expected to see them this week. And what's important about those, I think, is that the president has done a lot of executive orders, but 99.9% of them are, you know, directives. When it comes to immigration, the president can act. And so this will be, and this time they're being very careful in crafting it so they can defend it in court. So this will be real action, and this will have real impact.
And we don't know what that is, but we've seen some reports that it's similar to the initial one that ran into the legal problems. That is, it targets these same 7 countries, but there are some tweaks that would help it get around the legal issues?
Yes, it's the same countries as best we know, but it targets different travelers. So it'll make sure that U.S. citizens couldn't get swept up. And there's a question about whether it will affect people who already have visas or not. And so who they target is going to be the biggest change.
Yeah. Gordon Adams, is it going to make a big difference, I guess, politically and in the minds of people now that we've gone through this as to the real content of the second order, or is it really going to be viewed with the same emotion as the original?
Depends very much on what the content is going to look like. This is one of a number of examples of things that I would say characterize this entire transition as not normal. I've been through two presidential transitions, one at the beginning of the Clinton administration and the second when I was working with the Obama transition team. And although every transition has its ups and its downs and its uncertainties and who's going to be here and who's going to be there, I don't think I've ever in my history, and I've been involved in this area for probably 50 years, seen anything quite as abnormal as what we're seeing. And the immigration order is a classically good example of it. This is a very disruptive administration. In some ways, it's what his supporters wanted, but it is quite disruptive and very abnormal. So the immigration piece is a classic illustration of unanticipated consequences of trying to move too hard, too fast, too far without the right discussions that needed to be had with the agencies that were involved in policy on immigration policy. And ended up, in a sense, shooting themselves in the foot as a consequence.
So you think that, as you mentioned, maybe this is what his followers wanted, a shakeup in Washington, as he promised, to sort of charge in and do things differently. And he's done that. Are you saying, though, that you think there's a limit to how far he can go with that?
There's a clear limit to it, but it's not clear to me that he's reached the limit or, frankly, that he has a sense that he's at that limit. The Florida rally is a classically good illustration of his really liking to be out there with the crowds and being disruptive. And he was clearly being very disruptive when he was in Florida. And the executive orders are, for the most part, an upheaval, or at least they set in train an upheaval. And Gene's quite right to call them not exactly orders where he can set policy, but directives to agencies to start looking in these different areas. And whether you're talking about taxes or you're talking about immigration or you're talking about civil liberties and voting rights or the environment, it almost doesn't matter what agenda issue you pick. He clearly is a very disruptive force in the nature of American politics and in the nature of this transition. And yes, I think a lot of the people who voted for him wanted that kind of disruption. They were fed up with politicians. They were fed up with the lack of progress in Washington. They wanted some big change. Even the Bernie Sanders voters, who were very popular here in the state of Maine, were looking for something much more deliberately change-oriented than what they saw in Hillary Clinton as a candidate or in the typical Republican approach. Trump's not a Republican. Trump is an insurgent who captured the Republican Party. And that makes for a very – and comes in with little experience or background in government, hence a powerful tornado of disruption.
And really no one to turn to fill many of his cabinet posts because he doesn't have a political history of governance.
He has stuffed the cabinet with people who are either very wealthy, very powerful, very rich, or very opinionated, or in a couple of cases very bemedaled. But many of them not only lack experience in the government, lack knowledge of how the government processes operate, as his own White House does not have. They really don't. He didn't bring in a lot of people who knew how the government worked in the White House. Now, many transitions don't, so it's not too surprising that people didn't know exactly where the men's and ladies' rooms were and how to make the machinery of government work. He brought in an unusually disruptive crew of people, Conway, Bannon, who themselves have no experience of government and have a really hard time now trying to drive the machinery of government in a meaningful direction.
Ron Schmidt, we saw in this rally the president feeling buoyed, I guess, by the show of support after getting beat up in Washington. Do you think he was there to, I guess, to re-energize himself, to be, as he said, around people that supported him? Or was it a public display sort of saying, look, these are the people that matter to me, not the Washington press corps and the establishment that I'm trying to oust?
You know, I would not be surprised if Donald Trump assumes that the primary part of being president is reaching out to large crowds and trying to mobilize public opinion. He has no real interest, it seems, in directing policy or in pulling together the kinds of questions and decisions that are important to governing, and very much tends to emphasize the idea of, I don't know, representing the American people maybe or just addressing them directly. And I think the rally to some degree speaks to what he thinks his job is.
Gene, we've seen this war on the media emerging. I'm sure you've witnessed it firsthand. Is this a tactic? I mean, some people have said, look, this is the first step toward authoritarianism. But is this a strategy, or is this just his emotion about how he feels about being criticized in news stories?
Well, I do think it's both, really. I mean, the funny thing is, this is a president who spends an awful lot of time taking in the news. And then for his first month, it hasn't been good. The transition has been very rocky. So I think part of it is he is frustrated that he's not getting good stories. It's also a tactic. He did this during the campaign as well. If he can undermine our credibility, then it doesn't matter if we write a bad story because people won't believe us. So it's twofold. I think one of the reasons he held the they organized the rally was to put him in a setting where he would feel some positive feedback. We all know how isolating the White House can be, and he doesn't even have his family there. So this, I thought, was they did two things with that rally. First, they let him, blow off some frustration, let him feel the crowd, because he really reacts to that and enjoys that. And then secondly, it's a big crowd that serves as a reminder to the folks on Capitol Hill of where his power comes from.
Has Gene, though, has his, his, as you said, he did this during the campaign, this sort of contempt for the media and to dismiss now everything that he doesn't like as fake news. But has it had the effect of energizing the Washington press corps to be even more aggressive against him?
I don't think so. I mean, we cover presidencies with a lot of energy. We do, no matter who is the president. He may not have been ready for that. He's never seen it before. He's never been in this town before in this extended way, and certainly not in an official office. So, I mean, the press corps in Washington is aggressive, particularly when we're covering the White House. The other thing that has happened that is a little bit different is that every news organization and everybody in those news organizations is covering him. The same story. He's one big story. And so we have, our econ team is looking for stories about his economic policy. Our environmental and trade reporters, everybody is covering Trump. And so that creates a level of intensity that I think is a little bit different than if you had a traditional White House come into Washington.
Yeah, if you were trying to get away with something, now would be a good time to do it because you wouldn't get any coverage.
Well, but actually what I find interesting is that when his labor secretary couldn't escape the scrutiny, despite the fact that we're writing about Russia and we're writing about all these other big things, it's just there are too many. There's too much. There's so much attention. Even something like the labor secretary is going to get the attention too. There are just too many of us.
Yeah. Ron, as Gordon said, Donald Trump isn't really a Republican. He's created his own kind of party here. And that puts other Republicans, pretty mainstream Republicans, in an odd place trying to find a position. Some of them were critical. We've seen during the campaign, we've seen John McCain saying that Trump has gone too far with the attack on the press. But what does it mean for, politicians like Susan Collins, who, even is trying to find her way in a Senate as a moderate? Now she's got to negotiate this other world of the Trump White House. It must be a confusing time.
There's been a lot more scrutiny on Senator Collins' record lately, which I think relates to some degree to what Gene is talking about, the way that this is sort of ramping up these issues. This is a question a lot of people have asked, is what exactly does the Republican leadership, especially in Congress, intend to do about this situation? I mean, Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, has no experience in this kind of work. And usually the chief of staff is looked to be the one who keeps the rudder steady. I've heard a number of people talk about the days after the Iran-Contra story broke, when the Reagan administration brought in Howard Baker so they could continue with the president who, in Reagan's case too, liked his own alternative facts and couldn't really be disabused of them, but who brought in somebody who really knows how the policy process in Washington, D.C. works. And I think if the Republican leadership in Congress really wants to accomplish their agenda, they're going to have to try to find a way to bring that kind of pressure to bear on Trump.
Yeah. Gordon, is it going too far to say that there are three parties now, even though there are officially only two?
Well, there are to some degree, there's always been three parties. That is to say, the share of independents in the American voting populace has always been a very large share, at least for the last 20 or 30 years. And it tends to be distributed in a bimodal way, by which I mean some are very liberal and some are very conservative. So they tend to – independent doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to everybody. But I think the key here is that if a very disruptive agenda, a disruptive agenda which has real consequences for the independence of the judiciary, for the independence of the press, for very fundamental American constitutional values like free speech, freedom of assembly, all of these issues are on the table in an odd way much more vigorously than they've ever have been as a result of the Trump presidency. The question is, if you want to stand up for the Constitution, who can do that in a way that creates a firewall or an obstacle or a pressure on the Trump administration? Interestingly, I think despite the fact that he's made very many enemies at this point in the judiciary and elsewhere, the only force politically in the country that is capable of saying you really can't go any further than this is the Republican Party. It's odd and it's a very weak reed, but it is a substantially important impediment now because they have the majority in the Senate. They have the majority in the House. They have a number of state houses and state legislatures in their hands, 33 states and a number of state legislatures, right? They are, in a sense, the only real barrier. And right now, it's not clear they're going to be a barrier. And you see that in a number of ways. One of them is in fact, particularly the Russian investigation that Jeannie brought up right at the beginning. That is a major question. That's a big, big issue. And if it blows up in anybody's face, it's going to really compromise this administration. I mean, there's real constitutional questions at issue here. And the nature of that investigation is going to be very important. That puts somebody like Senator Collins in a very tricky position because both she and Senator King are members of the Intelligence Committee, which is one of the foci of investigation right now. And up to this point, Senator Collins has basically not called for either an independent or a bipartisan investigation of the relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russians and Flynn and the Russians and that whole ball of wax. So far, she's been very, very cautious about letting that investigation get too far outside the confines of the Intelligence Committee. I know she's going to come under pressure to do that because it's a very big issue. That's a huge ball of wax, that Russian situation. It's just not a minor, trivial, set-aside kind of issue. So she's going to be on that, on health care, where the Affordable Care Act is something that she was prepared to jettison when she voted for the budget resolution. She's come under criticism for that vote. She is one of the few moderates in the Republican Party, which is a substantially important position when it's 52-48 in the Senate.
Yeah.
Right. So she's going to face an intensity of pressure over the next months that a lot of senators aren't actually going to see.
I want to talk about the Democrats, too, and their situation heading into the midterms. I know we're getting a little political and apart from the day-to-day that is so interesting around this Trump presidency to date. But I want to touch on that, and I want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. And the Country Inn at Camden Rockport, offering family-friendly lodging in mid-coast Maine with 36 suites and 11 cottages. CountryInMaine.com.
What if For just one night, we put politics aside and talk about movies.
Tensions seem to be ratcheted up in the country, and we thought the Oscars are an island of focus for celebrating movies.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, producing the Academy Awards in 2017. That's next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30 right here on Main Public Radio. Main Public is seeking an experienced HR professional to lead all the aspects of our human resources functions for our statewide public broadcasting organization. We're looking for an HR director who's passionate about the work and mission of public broadcasting and has deep experience in all aspects of employee and labor relations, benefit sourcing, performance management, and HR compliance. If you or someone you know has the experience and enthusiasm that would complement Maine Public's dynamic and talented workforce, there's more information and details on how to apply on our website, mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the latest national news from our nation's capital. With me in studio, Ron Schmidt. He's an associate professor of political science at USM. Gordon Adams is also with us. He was senior White House budget official for national security budgets from 1993 to 97 and on the OMB transition team for incoming President Barack Obama. On the line with us from her office in Washington, D.C. is Jean Cummings, national political editor for the Wall Street Journal. We invite you to join the conversation. It's 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We were talking before the break about the position that Republicans are in. I want to ask about the Democratic Party, which is looking ahead to the midterm elections, hoping to win back some seats. And I'll open this to the group. Maybe, Jean, I'll start with you. Don't Democrats, though, have to be careful about just attacking Trump to stop him, as many in the party, their constituents, are asking them to do? Do they have to be careful about that to the extent that they're also trying to win over some of these voters that sought change went for Trump? In other words, the Democrats are sort of in a spot now of having to redefine themselves to go out and get support from people they might have lost in the past. Is there a risk of alienating them by going too far and attacking Trump?
Well, the Democrats are in their politics are really tricky because if you look at all the protests, even today, you know, there are people out in the streets protesting the president. Those are Democrats, and those are liberal independents. Those are people that the Democrats must keep. So if they don't keep those people may turn around and run a primary race against them. So many of the organizers of these protests are taking a look at the Tea Party's tactics. And one of the Tea Party tactics was putting up primaries against moderate Republicans. So the Democrats have to look both forward and back as they figure out their political moves. If the president's approval rating is going to sit at 40% or just slightly higher, it's not as hard a decision for them. So at the moment, it may feel safe, but that could change. And we are so far away from the midterms, anything can happen between now and then. I mean, we haven't even seen them try to move one major piece of legislation. So we got a long ways to go.
Yeah. Gordon?
I think what Jeannie's saying is very important here, but I think I would even be more broad about it. I don't think that what you're seeing in the country is just a bunch of Democrats speaking up. What I really sense, and I sense it not only nationally but here in the state of Maine, whether you look at the Women's March or you look at the airport demonstrations about the immigration executive order, or you look at a number of rather large demonstrations in places like Augusta and Portland in Maine, there is an uprising that is happening that is not like the old Occupy one. And the reason it's not like the old Occupy uprising, it's because the people who are now speaking up are people who intentionally are trying to hold the politicians accountable. And yes, I suspect the politics of most of them is moderate or progressive. Some people really don't like the way the administration is handling things. Some people really prefer a different solution. But if you step back and say, who were these Bernie Sanders people back when Sanders was running for the White House? Many of these people would not necessarily identify themselves as Democrats. They're not party loyalists. They're not traditional party workers. There are organizations all across the country, some of them out of the Indivisible website that was simply, here's how you approach your Congress, your member of Congress, and here's the lessons that the Tea Party should give us. There are organizations in Maine that are very involved in that. There's Indivisible organizations. There's Mainers for Accountable Leadership. There's the Maine People's Alliance. Some of them have been here a long time. Some, like M. Fowler, are entirely new. And they come out of people who've never been in politics before. And they're in politics. They're not in demonstrations for the sake of getting venting. They're in politics to actually hold members accountable in a way that some members, and I think in Maine, Collins is one of these examples, that will hold Mainer, the Maine delegation, accountable for the decisions that they've made, the votes that they've made, and are going to publicize that. And all of these groups are going to be doing this. So it's a slightly different – it'll be interesting to see how it develops, because it's a slightly different thing from what one saw in the Occupy situation. You're really seeing political focus, organizing, learning about politics, learning the way the Tea Party did to move in on political people, to run candidates against them, to hold them accountable, to do public meetings, to do personal meetings. It's something new, quite unprecedented in the recent history of American politics.
Yeah. Did you want to add something, Ron?
Yeah, I think Gordon is correct. But even if you look at a narrower focus, you know, we have a tendency to talk about politicians trying to hold on to their base. The Democratic Party has multiple bases, even among people who really see themselves as Democrats. You've got, you know, you've got organized labor. You have immigrant organizations. You have a variety of different racial and ethnic organizations. You've got more progressive groups, and then you also have this white working class, which may have permanently shifted to the GOP, but maybe not. And the party doesn't want to call that wrong, and they have to try to find a way to pull these different groups together. And they also really have to worry about the states. The Republican Party has been much better at mobilizing at the state level, and if the Democrats can't catch up, they have long-term problems.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We'll start with Brian in Windham. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How you doing
good
today?
Good, thanks.
I was listening to you folks talking about different parties, and you were saying, well, it's the Democrats and the Republicans, and then the third party really is the independents. But actually, the largest third party out there is the Libertarians, which mass media, for the most part, does not talk about. They scored over 3 million votes in this last election, and the only reason I believe they didn't get more is because nobody would talk about them.
Okay, well, we're talking about you now.
Okay. It's a very viable party. I've been a member for over 20 years. The party's been around over 40 years, and they had some very viable people running for office. There are a lot of smaller local elections they're involved with, and they actually had a candidate running for president who was on all 50 state ballots plus District of Columbia.
Yeah, so
and yet they wouldn't allow them onto the debates.
Brian, how does the Trump presidency and the Trump agenda align with the Libertarian Party platform as you see it? In other words, were Libertarians how do they align with Trump?
They're much too involved overseas, not enough involved here in the States. I don't believe in being isolationist the way we were back in the 20s and 30s, but I see Trump heading that way dramatically, plus being very autocratic. We believe in the Constitution and the rule of law. He believes in himself and his own benefit.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. I appreciate you joining the. Any comment from on the Libertarian role?
You know, I was struck by his emphasis on local candidates. That one of the problems that a lot of non-Democratic or Republican candidates have is to focus on presidency races, which, you know, that brings a lot of attention and possibly donations. But again, without being able to organize at the state and local level, a party can't really build.
Email from Janine, who writes, why are we not talking about how dangerous Bannon is? He has the president's ear and has a lot of influence and no experience in government, but does have a personal agenda. We talk too much about Mr. Trump. Pay attention to the ones in his ear. Gene Cummings, is the Washington Press Corps as focused on Steve Bannon and his role as they are on the man out front, Trump, who, after all, is the president.
Right. Well, certainly we're all keeping an eye on Bannon, and we report as much as we can when we know how he might be influencing the events inside the White House. But the president is the president, and while Bannon could try to influence Donald Trump, Donald Trump's the one with the real power. So we do keep our focus, I think, rightly on the president himself. But clearly, you know, this we're all getting to know this White House. It's different than what we're used to. And Bannon is playing a role that we have not entirely seen before. I mean, it's not, it's not completely new. I mean, every president brings in somebody who's close. So, you know, President Obama had Valerie Jarrett, and President Clinton had Mac McClarty. I mean, people, they bring in people they trust. And especially if you're new to this, you'd want someone near you who you trust. So it's not unusual to have someone like Bannon there. He brings a different agenda than we're used to. He is aggressive in ways that we're not used to when someone holds that particular slot. So we are keeping an eye on him.
Yeah, Gordon.
I think Gene's quite right that every president brings in the staff that they want to have around him, and includes some close people close to them. And sometimes they're not really well attuned to Washington. Jimmy Carter's White House staff was well known for this, people who had a real hard time dealing with the Congress because they basically had no experience of dealing with Congress. Frankly, I would put Bannon in a slightly different category, or it's almost a qualitative – it's a quantitative difference. There's a qualitative difference, if you will. And the piece for me that makes that very obvious is that I never saw those presidents put their national security – put that advisor, that policy and strategy political guy or gal into the National Security Council Principles Committee as a matter of memorandums, making him somebody who would participate directly in the discussions inside the National Security Council. That is quite without precedent, right? And I've served in transitions. I've looked at how this is done. I've argued about who ought to be sitting in those meetings. We did in the Obama transition about who ought to be sitting in those meetings. But almost nobody ever said, I want my political people in the middle of the national security deliberations of the United States. That's to me, kind of goes over the top. That's an excessive role given to somebody who's a strategic advisor. Yes, if he wants to let Bannon have his ear, every president gets a chance to do that. Making them, you know, in a written way, a participating voting member of the major national security deliberations of the United States goes way over the top.
And that's been a contributor possibly to his inability to find someone to take the national security advisor role.
There is no question in my mind that the chaos that surrounds the Trump White House is in part because Trump himself, and I believe this must be the president, otherwise, you know, I don't think it's Bannon, is saying, I operate this way, I manage this way, and everybody who is inside my operation must have loyalty here first, which means for the National Security Advisor, the job of preparing the agenda and the documents and getting the cabinet members involved in the Situation Room to buy in, getting the options honestly put before the president, all that stuff, you know, appointing people you know are substantively qualified to the director and deputy director positions, all that stuff is now on the table as not – and we've seen two people basically turn down the job, Admiral Harwell and Dave Petraeus, essentially because they wouldn't have any control over personnel. They wouldn't have any control over the internal deliberations and operations. This was all going to be handled in the White House. This is, I think, at the core of the disruptive quality of this White House.
All right, let's go to Steve in Orono. Hi, Steve.
Hey. I guess I'm sorry. I can't even believe I'm listening and watching the British Parliament take 3 hours to discuss the petition to downgrade our president's visit because of the petition says well-documented misogyny and vulgarity. I still don't know how we're seen in the world. All the folks in British Parliament, which isn't the full chamber, are debating, and they are saying, you know, the greatest ally of the United States, and they have the most respect for the democracy and the people of the United States. But you can just hear and see the trepidation, the concern, the stress that, you know, it's like it's they don't know. I mean,
right, right.
They want him there, the state visit. They'll take him there maybe undercover, but I don't know. I don't know what your folks think, but I think it's a time of which I'm 61. I've never experienced any of this. Certainly, confusion, stress, and worry about how we're looking, really, truly looking in the world.
Right. We'll take it. We'll address this in a moment. I got to take a quick break, but I did want to ask about. The vice president's reassurances of our European allies that, hey, everything's okay over here, despite what my boss has said. We'll get to that, and we'll get to your questions as well. But we're going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse thinks there's too much corporate money in politics. He says most of the time corporations influence Congress in subtle ways.
Except on some of the really big issues where the fossil fuel industry or the Wall Street folks say, cross us on this and we are coming after you.
I'm Kelly McEvers, Citizens United, lobbying and corporate money this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News. All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Presidential Secrecy and Transparency. We'll talk with writer Mary Graham, author of the new book Presidential Secrets, The Use and Abuse of Hidden Power. Graham is the co-founder of the Transparency Policy Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She'll talk about historical presidential secrets and what she describes as President Trump's lack of transparency. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And stay tuned in just a few minutes. At 2 o'clock, we'll have World Affairs, the world in disarray. That's the topic for today's World Affairs, coming up at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the political climate in Washington with me, well, and here for that matter, with me in the studio, Gordon Adams. He's professor emeritus at the American University School of International Service and a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. Ron Schmitz, an associate professor of political science in the Department of History and Political Science at USM. His forthcoming book is The Uncanny Friend, Reading Politics with Machiavelli. And, of course, Gene Cummings, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal, is on the line with us as well. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Had a caller before the break talking about, you know, what on earth are our allies and others around the world thinking of us and of this presidency right now. We saw VP Mike Pence, who has kind of emerged as a good cop in some ways, going to the European Union and saying, look, we're part of NATO, we're committed to the EU, doing, I think, some cleanup for this president. We'll start with you, Gene. What is Mike Pence's role emerging as here with respect to, I guess, ambassador to the world?
Right. I don't think we know yet. We know a few things about the role he will play. He definitely is the bridge to Capitol Hill. He spends an awful lot of time in the Capitol with Paul Ryan and others working to develop legislation. What I found most telling about that press conference today was the first question that the reporters, once they finished their opening remarks, that the reporters had to Pence was, okay, should we believe you or should we believe the president? Because they're not saying exactly the same thing. That's a big problem. That is a big problem for our allies. And it goes beyond Pence. We have Mattis. General Mattis, a defense secretary, has been out for the last 4 days trying to reassure our allies as well. And newly installed Secretary of State Tillerson was out traveling the world last week, also trying to do the same thing. But I think ultimately they want to hear it from the president, and they want to hear it more than once. because he's been so inconsistent in his messaging. And so I think our allies have good reason to be confused and concerned, and I don't think that the Pence trip is going to resolve that issue for them. It might help, and it might be the first couple of steps on the way to something that is improved, but it's not going to do it in one trip.
So who is the person who is supposed to stop the president from saying one thing and the vice president from saying another?
Well, that would be the president. Frankly, in American government, the vice president is a tag-along on the ticket. It's not somebody who got elected in his or her own right. So it's the president who has to decide where the consistency of message is coming from. And we're dealing with a president who clearly has a very broad sense of message, but not a detailed sense of message, nor particularly detailed knowledge of policy. And so you've got what amounts to freelancing, but dangerous freelancing by Mattis, by Kelly on immigration matters, by Tillerson on foreign policy matters. We had Mike Flynn for a while. Basically, people freelancing, trying to grapple with the uncertainty here. And I think this is another illustration of where we started. This is a very disruptive transition, and a transition that does not have lines of policy developed in it. I mean, I worked in two transitions. You were working policy in a transition from the day the election was over, you were working policy, so that you knew when you came in where it was you wanted to go with the political decisions, with the policy decisions. They have, not only do they not have that, they are unusually behind the curve in putting in place the people who would do it.
Right.
National Security Council staff. There are three deputy secretaries in 15 cabinet agencies nominated at this point, but not confirmed. In the State Department, they've eliminated six or eight people who were in major policy positions at the top as transition and acting people, and nobody is home. And there's a huge struggle with the White House between DOD, Mattis, and the White House, between Tillerson and the White House, about who has the authority to decide on who's going to get the nominations for those top policymaking jobs. So right now, you got a big gap between the worker bureaucrats and the few people who can travel around the world and say something, but nobody really working the agenda at the policy level. So that's extremely confusing and disruptive internationally.
Yeah.
Yeah, to go back to Steve's question about the British Parliament, I think that for our allies at this point, the president's consistent xenophobia or misogyny is less of a concern than his other utter inconsistency in foreign policy. I don't know if the president is trying to stymie the nation's enemies by switching track so quickly, but I think the people who've really been caught off their heels are our allies.
All right, let's go to Bob on Shebeg Island. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. This fascinating discussion. Listening to the press conference last week and then the rally in Florida, and I heard a lot of assertions by President Trump about how much they have accomplished and how everything is running like a well-tuned, fine-tuned machine. I wonder about when will there be a reckoning with the complete lack of legislation that has come forward, or explaining any of the broad policy or broad promises that President Trump made during his campaign or in the recent month about the great accomplishments that have already been forthcoming. All I am aware of for legislation is a law that allows environmental pollution and coal waste, and a lot of executive orders that stripped away some of the regulations that I think that are most necessary for the people.
Okay, Bob, thank you. Gene Cummings, the administration is under pressure here, for example, with repeal and replacing the Affordable Care Act. Will there be, or, you know, is there, do you have a sense that there's a plan around the corner or one coming soon? Or what are the implications really for not being able to deliver on some kind of replacement?
Well, you know, it's for Republicans in Washington, it's sort of one of those be careful what you wish for, because they've longed to have control of all both the House and Senate and the White House. Now they do, and now they've got to reckon with that. First of all, the question was when will there be a reckoning? I think people are pretty patient, and even though he said he was going to do things on the first day or very fast, I think most of the public and certainly his supporters don't expect, you know, huge things to happen in 30 days. So I don't think he's anywhere close to a moment when someone's going to make conclusive judgments. Now, about the legislation, well, they put out talking points. That was last week, and they mostly put out the talking points because they knew Republicans were going to be facing these kind of rowdy town hall meetings in which health care has become the major topic. So they have talking points, and they say those will be developed into legislation. But, you know, we'll believe it when we see it. And they're talking points that were given to the House. They were not necessarily given to the Senate. And, you know, everything for the next 2 years is going to be all about the Senate. Any limitation on what President Trump can do is only going to be measured by what's the most ambitious thing that Mitch McConnell can get out of his chamber, because that when it comes to legislation. So it's all about the Senate, and the Senate is not talking about a health care bill right now.
Yeah. Gordon?
Yeah, I agree very much with what Jeannie had to say there. What this underlines is that outside of the chaos that we see reigning in the transition in the Trump White House, there remains a Republican Party. There remains a Senate. There remains a House. And Speaker Ryan has had a policy agenda for a very long time. This is not a guy who knows nothing about policy. He's got annual documents that will tell you everything that he wants to do. And Mitch McConnell, while he doesn't have a policy agenda on everything, knows how to operate the machinery of government in the Senate extraordinarily well. Right now, you're not seeing out of them oppositional statements very much, individuals from time to time. Yes, McCain didn't like what Trump said about the press and so on. But you're not seeing a concerted Republican resistance. It could come. It could come because of the Russia investigation and people wanting to distance themselves from the Trump White House as a result of the Russia investigation. You're certain to see things like the Affordable Care Act replacement come up in some way. As Gene said, there's talking points now. They don't offer much detail, and they certainly don't fulfill the promise of repeal and replace by the end of January. We're nowhere near that and never were going to be, right? You see it. I think you're going to see it on immigration as we face the consequences of a very draconian effort to expel immigrants in the United States. And the rubber, because I'm a budget guy, I got to say it, the rubber hits the road when this guy's got to present a budget to the Congress at some point, you know, and the Defense Department, I know, is grinding away trying to produce its own budget numbers. That Mulvaney, the budget director, just came on board, and I've worked at OMB. I know how long it takes to develop these documents, right? I don't know when we're going to see that budget, but in government, budgets are policy. So at some point, they're going to have to say, here's where we're putting the bucks behind this agenda, this issue, this environmental reg, this military aircraft, this housing policy, whatever it's going to be, you write it when you get to the budget. So the challenge for them is whether the chaos at the top can accommodate a fixed deadline and a fixed process that's got to produce some real substantive numbers and policies.
All right, let's go to the phones quickly if we can to Eliza in Appleton. Hi, Eliza.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question about our Senator Susan Collins for your panel, and my question is, why does she continue to have a reputation as a moderate when, in fact, most of the time when she sees the vote, it seems to me at least, going the way of the Republican majority, she dares to vote in the minority against issues. But I just don't understand how she can continue to claim to be a moderate when she's not standing up against some of the extreme appointments President Trump has made.
Yeah,
I'd be interested in your panel comments.
Sure. Ron?
That's a great question, Eliza. Thanks for asking it. Senator Collins can represent herself as a moderate because under the current conditions in Congress, someone who votes with their party some 95-96% of the time and usually only votes against them when it's not going to matter actually does count as moderate. Her position there actually puts her to the, if you will, middle, although the middle is way to the right of center. So that in and of itself is a commentary, I think, on the state of Congress.
It's very interesting to see what I think a critical position she's going to find herself in, because as a moderate, she has been able to work this sort of careful road.
You had air quotes in there.
Air quotes were in there, yeah. Right? You know, that she works her way very carefully with some issues. She does some very good things in the Senate. She does some things that are good for the people of the state of Maine. And there clearly is a sense today, and it's where I started with, this is disruptive. We're now seeing at the Maine level people who are saying that's not enough. We now have an administration that we're looking to you, Senator Collins, among others, Senator King and Poliquin and Shelley Pingree and all of them, to stand up and defend the agenda of the last 70 years, even some of the Republican accomplishments. I mean, after all, clean water and clean air were a Nixon initiative, you know, so even some of the Republican agenda of the last 70 years. And we are expecting you to take a step in leadership terms that I think, among other people, Susan Collins has not traditionally expected herself to do. And that's why you see these demands, incessant demands for her to hold a town meeting, which is something she and Senator King, too, have been reluctant to do. Right. But it's a different politics. It's the Tea Party version in a different community saying what we are holding you to in terms of accountability is different from the way we have allowed you to operate as our senator for the last N years.
Well, so we're almost out of time. I did want to ask Gene Cummings, what's the Wall Street Journal front page going to look like tomorrow, Gene?
Oh,
or do we know yet? It's only.
I don't.
It's only
I don't
two.
We know yet. Yeah. I certainly don't know. So.
Yeah. All right. Gene, Gordon, Ron, thank you all for being here today. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Gene Cummings is national political editor for the Wall Street Journal. Gordon Adams, professor emeritus at the School of International Service at American University. He was actively involved in politics and policymaking in the Capitol and served as a senior White House budget official for national security budgets from 93 to 97 and on the OMB transition team for incoming President Barack Obama. Ron Schmidt is an associate professor of political science in the Department of History and Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. His forthcoming book, The Uncanny Friend, Reading Politics with Machiavelli. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the health of Maine's fisheries, from scallops to herring, shrimp to lobster. Join host Jennifer Rooks, who welcomes Pat Kelleher, Maine's Commissioner of Marine Resources. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.